Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. This month, we talk to the curator of the Hall of Heroes Superhero Museum in Elkhart, Indiana. We check in on a Gibson City man about his bike trek from San Francisco back to Illinois. And we have a special in-studio interview with Phil Clark of the local didgeridoo band Tree Thump. We'll have those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. Of course, summer road trips are nothing new. Many people like to get a taste of the open road. But one Gibson City man has spent this summer biking from San Francisco back to Illinois. His name is Paul Supawanich. I talked with him a few weeks ago when he was halfway into his trip.
I'm at Glen Canyon Recreation Area, so this is in central southern Utah. And I'm looking out over Lake Powell, so 200 miles down the way, Glen Canyon Dam is blocking up the waters from the Colorado River, which is forming this enormous lake. So I'm kind of standing here on the banks and getting ready to camp for the night. And this is day 15 of this bike trip that I've been taking. And so my trip started in Berkeley, California, and it'll end in my hometown in Gibson City, Illinois. And kind of the premise of the trip was, well, a couple different things happened all at the same time. Well, and one of those being that I was able to finish up an internship that I had in San Francisco and lined up a job for September, and so I had this time off. And something that I'd always wanted to do is be able to ride my bike just to really see the country at a nice pace from my home at present, in Berkeley, to where I grew up and lived for 18 years in Gibson City. At the same time, I always had after I left Gibson City to go off to college, I always felt that I'd wanted, to have a chance to give something back to some of the things that I'd done while I was growing up there. And so it's a bike ride across country, but also I'm doing a fundraiser for a Ford County Youth Soccer Club there in Gibson City, and also doing a fundraiser for the Atlanta Bike Coalition, which I was involved with when I was at college down in Atlanta.
And how much have you raised so far?
That's a good question, Jason. I've been on the road for about 2 weeks, and when I left, at least from what I know, I was about $3,400 raised. And so I was shooting for about $4,000. So I think I'm pretty close at this point, but it's really hard to tell. I just haven't really had access to the computer as much as I'd like and haven't been able to tally up the donations and the fundraising. But I think I'm probably pretty close at this point. At least that's what I'm hoping so.
So why a bicycle? A lot of people who take these trips across country, a motorcycle, a car. Why a bike?
Well, there's something about bicycling and seeing the country, and I think, the American way is to really take the cross-country road trip and really get it taken all the sights. But there's something about riding at a little bit slower pace and really having that 360-degree view and being able to jump off at any time and in every little stop, not feeling bad for, pulling the car over and stopping. And when you're on your bike going 12 miles an hour, you see something cool, you jump off, you put the bike on the side of the road, you look around for a little bit, and then you hop right back on. And so there's something about it that's a little bit different than riding in a car and road tripping across the country. And as I've been riding and putting on the miles, I feel like there's something similar to maybe having a motorcycle. I've passed a lot of motorcyclists and talked to a lot of them, and I guess there is a sense of freedom in having kind of the open air around you, but particularly on the bike, being able to take it at a nice, slow pace. And don't get me wrong, there's plenty of stretches where I wish I was going a little bit or a lot faster through some of these barren parts, but there is something nice about taking these and really getting to take in the scenery going at that speed.
So tell us a little bit about your setup. How many miles do you ride a day? Where do you stay at night? Anything unusual happen so far on the way?
Sure. Well, the typical day, and it really varies depending on the elevation. Elevation is really the key thing. Well, elevation and wind, really. But I plan my days when it's hilly. I'll be climbing maybe 2,000, 3,000 feet. I'll be trying to shoot around for 60 to 70 miles. Once it flattens out, once I get past the Rockies, I'm going to hope to do closer to 90 to 110, maybe 120 miles a day. And then, of course, there are other factors. I had one day where I was crossing over, it was Carson Pass, and that's going over the Sierra Nevadas in California, and I got hailed on for a good bit, and I had some pea-sized hail coming down on me. And there's also those windy days. I was coming down from Milford, Utah, coming into Cedar City, kind of around Zion National Park and such, where I was pretty much going straight south into a 20-mile-per-hour headwind. So my average on flat land is about 15 to 20 miles an hour. But when it's windy like that, it's just totally frustrating, and it knocks you down to about 6 miles per hour. And the harder you pedal, the harder it pushes back. So those are really the big factors in how much distance I cover. In terms of anomalies, well, I tell you, last night I had a great thing happen. Well, I had the last 2 days have been really difficult for me, just in terms of big climbing days and conquering maybe about 3,000, 5,000 feet of elevation per day, and just trying to cover a lot of distance. And here in Utah in particular, the roads, in most of the country, the roads, they average them out or max them out about it at a 7% grade. But here, gosh, they don't hold back. So they have some roads here that are 10, 12, 14%. So it just really knocks you out. But I rolled into this town last night, and I was looking for a place to stay. And you know, at this point, you know, after having a hard day, I wanted to jump into a motel and just have a nice warm shower and crash in a bed. And the one place I roll into in this town is probably about 300 people. I had the no vacancy sign open, so, you know, I hung my head down and started to turn around. But the woman inside came out and said, no, we have a room open. And I walked in, and she just threw the key at me, and she said, you know, we're closed on Sunday, but, you know, the room's on us, no problems, just let us know when you take off. So really a great thing, really nice people out here, and I was just a godsend last night. But for most of the trip, it's been a combination of doing a little moteling and camping, and I've been couch surfing a little bit, so there's an online website called couchsurfing.com where you can get matched up with people that are willing to host you or have a guest stay for the night. So I've done a couple couch days, and mostly in central and eastern part of California.
You do have a blog where you do update when you can, mm-hmm. so people can check on your progress, and you do include photos of where you've been. If people want to follow you, what's that address?
My blog is supaonabike.blogspot.com. So that's supaonabike, supaonabike.blogspot.com. And, yeah, you're right. On there, when I get to a computer, I try to post video and pictures and things and the like. And my fiance, who actually lives in Atlanta, was, of course, a little concerned about me riding the solo. So she got me a little tracking device. So there's actually a link on there where you can actually see where I'm at any given time during the day while I'm riding, which is pretty cool. So if you go on there, you can click on the link, and it'll show you right where I'm at.
That was Paul Supawanich. He has spent the last few months biking from San Francisco to Gibson City. We talked a few weeks ago during the middle of his trip, and we are happy to report he has returned to Illinois safe and sound. You can read all about his travels on his website, supaonabike.blogspot.com. You're listening to Sidetrack. We heard over and over again about the government program Cash for Clunkers. It got drivers thinking about exactly what happens to dead cars, regardless of how they die. Sean Ali from the Environment Report looks at how car recycling works and who's trying to improve it.
You might not think of it this way, but your car just might be the biggest thing that you own that eventually gets recycled. I mean, someday, either you're going to junk it or maybe some future owner will. Anyway, I'm out in front of a car shop in my neighborhood, and with the health of cars in mind, I thought I would ask some of the people around here, percentage-wise, just how much of a junked car eventually gets recycled.
I would say maybe like 5% of the car.
I'll say like, I don't know, 20, 30% probably of the car.
I guess the recycled one can be like 30%.
Maybe, like, I guess, like 50%.
About 70%.
In my little unscientific survey here, it turns out that most people are giving a pretty low estimate of how much of a junked car ends up being recycled. The auto industry and the Federal Environmental Protection Agency say about 80% of a junked car gets recycled, and the rest heads to landfills. Sounds pretty good, but that means we bury about 5 million tons of junked car pieces each year. To understand why they can't recycle even more of the car, I'm going to talk to Jim Watson, who runs ABC Auto Wreckers in a suburb just south of Chicago.
We don't want to landfill anything. The objective is to take the entire vehicle, process it, and have all the parts be used.
Watson shows me his shop where he pulls parts for the used auto market. A dozen workers lift hoods, twist tires, and pull out stuff I don't even recognize. It's kind of like an assembly line, but in reverse.
They do an analysis and inventory each of the parts on the car that have a probability of sale or what we've identified. And then they will harvest or pull those parts off the car.
Watson and some of the bigger auto wreckers have part scrapping down to a science, but it's expensive to keep pulling parts and keep space open for scrap yards. Eventually, Watson pulls off everything useful from a car, and then he sends it to a car shredder.
A machine that actually beats it apart and shreds the car into small fist-size or hand-size components.
Recyclers can pull out big shreds of steel and aluminum, but about 20% of the car is left over. This shredder residue gets tossed into landfills, but scientists are thinking about how to recycle this shredded mess. One of these scientists works at a lab at Argonne National Laboratory near Chicago.
This is what shredder residue looks like.
Dr. Bassam Jodi reaches into a cardboard box and scoops a jumble of car seat foam, metal cable, wood, and shards of plastic. Jodi says shredder residue is a recycler's nightmare.
Maybe there's more than 20 different types of plastics. And I tell you about plastics are generally incompatible. They're not like each other. They don't work together very well.
Jodi is developing machines to safely clean and separate all this stuff.
The more materials you have in the mixture, the more difficult it is to separate. So the trick is to do it economically and to be able to produce materials from it that could be used in value-added products.
What can they make out of?
Car parts. For example, this is a steering column cover.
Jodi says he gets a kick out of his work. After all, he just might squeeze a bit more good out of our cars. For the Environment Report, I'm Sean Ali.
This is Sidetrack. Recently, the news came out that Disney is buying Marvel for $4 billion. Whether this will usher in a new golden age of superheroes remains to be seen, but it seems that with the many movies, TV shows, video games, and of course comic books, it is a good time to be a fan of superheroes. Alan Stewart of Elkhart, Indiana knows a thing or two about superheroes. Well, actually, he knows a lot about them. He's the curator of the Hall of Heroes Superhero Museum. I talked to him recently and asked him first, what's the most popular exhibit in the museum?
Boy, that's a tough question. Because we've got the whole museum's pretty popular. Actually, probably the building itself, because our building, and I'm not sure if you've seen our website or anything, but the building is a two-story replica of the Hall of Justice. So people, when they pull up here, they're just amazed by just seeing a full-size Hall of Justice.
And that's from the old Super Friends.
That's right, exactly.
Saturday morning cartoon.
That's right, yep. And then also inside the museum, we have a replica of the Batcave set from the 60s TV show, complete with a bat pole even going down the middle of it.
How long has the museum been open, and what can we find in it?
The museum's been open just a little over 2 years, and our museum is the only comic book and superhero museum in the world. We basically cover the whole 70-year history of superheroes in comics, toys, movies, film, cartoons, you name it. And that's what you're going to see here. You're going to see the largest superhero collection. We've got over 50,000 comic books in the museum. We have every comic book from 1959, from the last 50 years. We have every single superhero comic book from the last 50 years up to the new stuff that's out this week. We have probably over 10,000 miscellaneous toys, action figures from the 1940s to present. We've got over 100 pieces of original art, of comic book pages and animation cells. We've got individual sections. We've got like a Spider-Man section, an X-Men section, a Batman section, Superman, Super Friends, you name it, we've got it in here.
So what's the mission of the museum?
Our two main missions for the museum. The first one is education. I actually hold a teaching and history degree, and I am just a huge believer and promoter that comic books and superheroes are such a huge untapped educational resource. We have a big art and history section. We actually have a Golden Age / World War II history section here in the museum, and I actually go around and guest lecture. I do several lectures at area universities. I teach a comics and World War II lecture for history professors. I also go through and teach lessons on for teachers as they're working on their teaching degrees on how to use comic books and superheroes in the classroom, and I help them develop lesson plans. In fact, that's one of my other big projects right now. I'm working with several teachers and members of our board of directors here at Hall of Heroes to we're going to be launching a national book, and it's going to be called Comics in the Classroom. And it's going to actually include lesson plans. Every chapter of the book will be on a different subject. Like one subject will teach art using superheroes, another chapter will use history, English, science, you know, and so on and so on. Every chapter will be teaching a different subject, and complete with the lesson plans and everything for the teachers.
So what is it about superheroes that has attracted you to them, and what made you want to collect all this stuff?
It's kind of, I guess, an addiction would be a good word. You know, I mean, I just got hooked on it at a young age, and just have been addicted ever since. I mean, like I said, yeah, I've got the largest collection that exists. It had been on TV several times. I actually owned a comic book publishing company that ended up becoming one of the top five small press comic book companies back in the 90s, and about a half a dozen of the guys that work with me and trained underneath me are now working for Marvel and DC, drawing Spider-Man and Superman and Batman, all the big ones. And I've written comic books professionally as well, so not only am I a collector, but I've been in the business as well.
Wow. So who's your favorite?
My personal favorite is Green Lantern from Justice League, Super Friends.
Because?
I grew up watching the old Super Friends cartoons, and that was just a character that really appealed to me.
So where do you get the items that are housed in your museum? Where have you gotten them from, and where do you continue to search them out at?
I've got there's a local comic store where I get all the new stuff that comes out, and then I special order a lot of things. eBay is just a tremendous help. I'm buying stuff all the time on eBay. In fact, that's where I locate a lot of our older books, because our second main mission, other than education, is historical preservation. You know, the comic books are historical artifacts, the very old ones from the 40s, 50s, World War II years, and that is something we are the only organization dedicated to preserving a entire collection of every comic book. And right now I'm buying on eBay, you know, comic books from 1957, 1958, filling our gaps all the way back to 1938, which was the beginnings of comic books with Superman. So we've got everything from 59 on up, full runs of everything, and we're just, you know, we're working our way down.
Wow. So since you have this broad spectrum of history, of comic book history, from 1938, the first appearance of Superman, to the current day, what do you think is the biggest change superheroes have gone through in that time?
Probably the biggest change was probably when they almost got canceled in the 1950s. Comic books almost ceased to exist in the 1950s. You almost didn't have Spider-Man or X-Men or Hulk or any of these that didn't appear until the 60s when Marvel started. Just due to one book that came out by a child psychologist, Dr. Frederick Wortham, he wrote a book blaming the rise of juvenile delinquency on comic books. And then you had the fallout from that was you had churches and schools doing comic book burnings Bannings and Bannings. And to just to basically to compare it to today, you know, it'd be like if your parents today caught you with drugs in your room, it'd be that's how it was if a you know your parent caught you with a comic book in the 1950s in your room. That's how much trouble you'd be in.
Yeah, and that book was called Seduction of the Innocent.
Seduction of the Innocent. We actually have a first edition from 1954 on display here in our museum.
And that actually led to congressional hearings.
That's right, yep. And out of the congressional hearings came the comic books code that still exists today. It's very similar to the video game, you know, codes and everything that you hear about now, but it started with comic books back in the 50s.
So what is the state of superheroes today?
You know, the comic books, you know, not so many people are getting the comic books, but the characters are huge. I mean, obviously, you know, Hollywood has taken very big notice over the last 10 years on superheroes, and that's a lot of their focus now.
So what is a typical visitor to your museum like? Is it are they young? Are they old? Men, women?
No, you know, our museum actually appeals to all ages because we cover the whole 70-year history here at our museum. You know, if somebody comes here, no matter their age, we have different sections. We have a Hollywood section which promotes. We have tons of autographs of all the celebrities that have played in all the superhero movies. We actually have a lot of props from some of the movies. We have one of the Batarangs used on one of the Batman movies. We have some of the original costumes from some of the movies and TV shows. So people that are into that, they don't know a lot about the comics, but they know the movies and stuff. They're going to see a lot of stuff that's going to appeal to them. We've had people come in here, you know, three generations, and they would each find things that they remember from their childhood. Our museum is almost like a time machine. It really doesn't matter your age, and even men and women, you know, the guys definitely, but the women, you know, we've got Batgirl, we've got Wonder Woman, we've got, you know, Supergirl, we've got Catwoman. You know, we have a lot of female character exhibits as well here at the museum.
That was Alan Stewart, curator of the Hall of Heroes Superhero Museum in Elkhart, Indiana. You can find them online at myspace.com/Hall of Heroes Museum. You've got attuned to Sidetrack. Getting involved in a social or environmental cause these days is as easy as clicking your mouse. Some people think grassroots activism is just changing its face as technology changes. But other people think we're becoming slackers. Rebecca Williams explores whether we're a nation of slacktivists.
The other day, I met this guy, Patrick Deal, and I was trying to get him to describe himself.
I'm a Pisces, and I enjoy long walks on the beach and horseback riding. Good sense of humor, still gets pimples.
Add to that, slacktivist. That's a slacker activist. But he was telling me that he wasn't always this way. For 20 years, he was one of those door-knocking, envelope-licking activists. He worked for a governor. He used to drag his little daughter to rallies. Now, he's just burned out.
I could get on the phone and call somebody about an issue, but I choose to sit down on Facebook and hit three mouse clicks and a return and feel good about myself.
And lately, his slacktivism has hit a brand new low.
My little green patch is dry. It means I'm neglecting it.
If you're a Facebook virgin, the little green patch is this application that lets you send plants to your friends' online gardens. The idea is the more you play, the more money advertisers will give to save the rainforest.
So wait, so did you actually do this for a while? And you felt good about it?
Yes. Yes, I did, because I thought, well, my spending time on here is leading to something. It's contributing to something bigger than myself.
But then Patrick got in trouble. His wife, Anita, said he was spending way too much time online. Little Green Patch died. He'd rather play another online game like Mafia Wars. But, you know, at least at one time, Patrick was very active. Some people think clicking on a little green patch is their contribution to a better world.
That's a trending topic. That's a trending term, slacktivist.
Apollo Gonzalez works for one of those big environmental groups, Natural Resources Defense Council. He's what's called a net roots manager. You might say it's his job to get slacktivists off their butts.
If you measure the one-click activism or slacktivism against someone who's visiting their representative on the Hill once a year, then yeah, I think it's on the low end of what can be done. But we've got to start somewhere with a lot of these people.
So Apollo blogs and tweets and uses online social media to get people talking. Because talking sometimes actually leads to doing something.
We have a world where we are more connected than we ever have been, and a world where we can share our stories faster and more richly than we ever have been able to. And that's great for people who are fighting for a cause.
And there's actually some research to back this up. Scott Campbell studies new media at the University of Michigan.
There have been some studies recently that show that when people use text messaging as reminders to go out and vote, we do see a significant increase in voter turnout.
He says cell phones and the internet are basically giving us more ways to communicate, and that's good for us as a society. But he says we do have to be a little careful, because if all our online friends think like we do, we can become little isolated e-communities. Basically, the more Facebook friends you have and the more new ideas you can share, the better. So if you want to be a better slacktivist, you might have to make some choices. You could sign 1 million online petitions. I mean, there are 15,000 environment causes on Facebook. And then there are all those other things like mafia wars and all the other distractions that people like Patrick have to deal with.
I've been kidnapped to Barcelona, but I'm going to ignore that.
See, you just say ignore, okay? Ignore.
Someone just sent me a slap on the rear end. I'm going to ignore that. I wouldn't, but my wife is right here, so I'm going to ignore it.
With distractions like these, even slacktivism is getting to be hard work. For the Environment Report, I'm Rebecca Williams.
Still to come, an in-studio chat with didgeridoo player and maker Phil Clark from the local band Tree Thump. Stay tuned. This is Sidetrack. In Virginia, the seafood industry is trying to keep stingrays away from commercial oyster beds by promoting the rays as a great new bar food. But environmentalists caution that stingrays are vulnerable to overfishing. More from independent producer Alex Halperin.
There's a new plan to turn stingrays into the next American seafood craze. Advocates say fishing ray meat could be a good moneymaker and have environmental benefits. But some worry that a ray fishery will devastate the species. Mike Hutt is with the Virginia Marine Products Board. He explains why you may enjoy eating a stingray.
It is very high in protein, low in fat. It's a very tender meat. It's a good, clean, soft bite to it. It's not really chewy or gristly or tough.
The fish can be eaten as a steak, but Hutt thinks there's more money in turning stingrays into deep-fried bar snacks. He thinks Chesapeake strips and spicy Chesapeake stingers could compete with mozzarella sticks and fried calamari. Distributors are working to make these snacks a fixture on menus and in frozen food aisles. This would be a new use for what some people call a nuisance fish. Vast schools of cow-nose rays migrate north from Florida each summer. They glide into the Chesapeake Bay and cause problems for the seafood business here. The rays get tangled in nets, and they snack on commercial oyster and clam beds, crushing the shells with the enamel plates in their mouths. The shellfish industry considers rays a huge threat. But some scientists and environmentalists are concerned. They fear a growing appetite for ray meat would harm the fish's population.
You can see the uterus, only the left uterus. This animal has two uteri. They have a left one and then they have a right one. Only the left one is functional.
Bob Fisher is with the Virginia Institute of Marine Science. He's dissecting a female ray on a metal table. The body cavity is very bloody. It looks like an alien autopsy from late-night television. Fisher is studying the ray's reproductive capacity. His research will help develop a management plan for a ray fishery in the Chesapeake. Females have gestation periods of almost a year, and generally give birth to only one pup. Because they take so long to reproduce, cow-nose rays could be vulnerable to overfishing.
A lot of people on the pro-harvesting marketing side can see that there are benefits to taking the rays out and cannot understand what the repercussions will be. And that's something no one really knows. I'm in favor of a fishery, but it would always have to be a limited, sustainable fishery.
Environmental concerns aside, it's not clear whether people want to eat ray. LD Amery and Company is a seafood firm in Hampton, Virginia. Winches are hoisting buckets of fish from boats onto a conveyor belt. Workers then sort the fish for processing. Maggie Haynes, who works for the company, is showing me how to fillet a ray.
So normally what happens is they cut the wing off first. And see how it cuts up high? Because there's good meat in there.
So far, there's hardly any domestic market for ray meat. It can be a hard sell. Cow-nose ray is bloody, with a texture like pork, but most Americans like their fish light and flaky. And as the industry is trying to interest the public, there are also challenges for the fishermen. Rays are unwieldy. They're a yard across and have a short toxic barb on their tail. Despite all these problems, the seafood industry says it wants to develop a fishery that won't harm the species. The environmental community hopes they mean it. In Hampton, Virginia, I'm Alex Halperin.
You're listening to Sidetrack. That is Phil Clark with the Didgeridoo, and we're here in the WILL Performance Studio. He's a member of the band Tree Thump and one of the owners of the Tree Thump Digi Company in Fithian, Illinois. Well, hi there.
How you doing?
So tell us a little bit about the Didgeridoo, what you were just playing, the instrument you were just playing there, and what drew you to learn how to play a didgeridoo?
Oh, right. Well, sort of the two-minute soundbite on the didgeridoo is it's a wind instrument of Australian Aboriginal origin. Originally probably only played in the north of Australia prior to European contact. That's where the trees that they make these things out of grow. Over in Australia, it's made with sort of a unique construction process. They're actually termite-hollowed, standing living trees. So we have very different termite ecology in the States. Over here, when termites attack a tree, they just devour it. In Australia, when a termite attacks a eucalyptus tree, because it has a chemical in the creosote of the wood that's toxic to termites, they won't eat the living sapwood. They'll only eat the dead heartwood. So you get these naturally hollow, pipey trees And if you know what you're looking for, you know how to listen for the right sort of hollow when you tap on the tree, you can just cut them down and you have a ready-made didgeridoo ready to play. They're used by Aboriginal people in a number of sort of just recreational, musical, and ceremonial contexts. They've also been incorporated into rock bands by Aboriginal people. More recently, many of your listeners might remember a band called Yota Yindi from the early 90s that made the Billboard charts briefly with didgeridoo and their dance music. And sort of since then, you know, due to a variety of reasons, the didgeridoo spread all around the world. It's been an instrument used in sort of a variety of experimental jazz, rock musics. And we got into it, actually I got into it about, I suppose, almost 8 years ago now, in my junior year at Arizona State University. I was a brass player. I played the tuba, the bass trombone in college. I was a performance major there. And we had a tradition in college of taking the longest road trip you can on a 3-day weekend, right? So we'd start out of Phoenix, Arizona. We'd hop on I-10 and just go as far west and then as far north as we could, camp, and turn around and come back and get there in time for class on Monday. So we spent a lot of time in coastal towns, and one place that we really liked the beaches was Laguna Beach, California, which is very boutique-y sort of a town. And I remember one road trip that junior year, we stopped in a store that sold nothing but didgeridoos. And, you know, being a brass player with sort of a, I don't know, general ethnic music interest, right? You know, I saw these things and knew I knew how to play them, at least at a basic level, knew I could get a sound out of them. And, you know, tried one in the store, couldn't do that much with it, didn't think anything of it until 2 weeks later when I heard a recording of this great Aboriginal didgeridoo player named David Hudson, who is sort of locally renowned in the Cairns and North Queensland area, and thought, wow, I really missed something. I need to check this out. I need to give this more time. So sort of started researching it on the internet and eventually bought my own and taught myself to play. And that was the beginning. it's been a ride since then, for sure.
Well, why don't you describe, you brought four in with you, just describe them, what they look like, because they don't look like what people think when they think of Australian didgeridoos. These are much, they're shaped a lot differently.
Right. I've got four with me today. These are all didgeridoos that we've made out of local woods found in the United States. Actually, one of them is not wood, but we'll get to that. Three of these are from Illinois. This one right here is sort of a mystery, actually. We're not sure what kind of wood it is because it was so long fallen. You can see it's got all sorts of lovely spalting on it and worm patterns that make these sort of sunbursts in the bark at the end of it.
Yeah, it's very natural. There's no painting. It's
right. It comes from an oak forest, so it very well may be that, but the grain's really too changed by spalting and by worm patterns to really tell. It comes from the same area as this one here, which is an oak didgeridoo, which actually used to be a fork in a tree, but we kept the fork and only one branch to make sort of a giant bell on it, which gives it some pretty interesting playing characteristics. We've also got a poplar, which is a fallen branch off an ornamental tree in Charleston, Illinois. These other two are from Oak Forest up near the Sandwich, Illinois area on the river, where my business partner's family lives. And then this one, this long sort of painted black one, is actually the stalk of an agave plant, of a century plant. I'm from New Mexico originally, so these things grow all over where I come from. And this is one I made prior to the inception of Tree Thump the band and Tree Thump Didgeridoo Company, the business. We don't, as you said, we don't paint a lot of the instruments we make, and this is sort of my early effort and sort of before I had done a lot of thinking about how I wanted to approach didgeridoo making. We don't paint our instruments sort of out of respect for Aboriginal tradition. For Aboriginal people, for the Yolngu people that I've spent time with in Arnhem Land in Australia, their paintings are part of sort of a sacred endowment from their ancestors. It's sort of on the same level as language in determining their identity and who they are. And they really do consider it stealing when people imitate artwork that's like theirs without permission. And because of that, we just try to respect that and make the wood beautiful just with its natural characteristics. We leave it sort of untouched, largely unfinished. We do a little bit of staining, but that's it.
So why don't you grab one of those and sort of give us a primer on what it takes to play the didgeridoo.
Okay. So I'm holding this this large oak stick.
The one that was the fork.
Now, yeah. This is didgeridoo number 5 of 2009. And yeah, you can see it did used to be a fork. The larger trunk of the tree we've left and kept only the branch. To play one of these, it's very similar to playing any Western brass instrument, right? It's the basic drone is made by buzzing your lips. And that gives you this sound, just a simple. Which in and of itself isn't terribly interesting. If anyone just tuned in there, they probably thought there was something wrong with their radio. It just sounds like an electronic hum. But the sort of art of the didgeridoo comes not from sort of training your fingers and training external, you know, training your body to respond to external things, but rather training the inside of your body to be able to produce different sounds, right? So I buzz my lips. That makes that basic drone. But I can also use my tongue as an articulation tool. So I can make percussive rhythms using that drone with just my tongue, doing things like. I cheated a little bit, actually. I was also changing the shape of my mouth there. That's how you get that sort of characteristic, almost nasal didgeridoo sound, right? Is you hold your mouth in the same shape you would use to pronounce certain vowel sounds, and that changes the fundamental sound of the didgeridoo like this. You can even sort of pronounce distinct vowels with it, like. So after you have that foundation, you can sort of lay in more advanced techniques. You can start incorporating a little bit of voice into your playing to get sort of more complex drone sounds by humming over the drone like this. Or you can get the characteristic didgeridoo animal noises. You can get dog barks. Or you can even get sort of more complex bird call type sounds like. And from there, it's as far as you want to take it. You know, people play this instrument in very rhythmic styles. People also use this instrument, you know, as part of sort of meditation practices, to accompany yoga classes. It's actually a fairly common thing. And, you know, it's got this very unique voice and perhaps, I guess, made more unique by the technique of circular breathing, which everyone who's sort of heard about the didgeridoo, I guess, knows this. You keep the sound sustained by breathing in through your nose while you're squeezing air out with your cheeks to create a sustained sound. You can't actually breathe in and out simultaneously. You're actually using your cheeks sort of as a bellows to sustain while you're breathing in.
And you guys actually, you and the band Tree Thump, you take this onto a stage. You take this onto a stage and you perform rock music with it.
Right, yeah. You know, I mean, the influences we draw on are sort of disparate. You know, there's sort of a lot of AC/DC in there, but there's also a heavy measure of bluegrass and funk. We try to approach sort of playing in a band with a didgeridoo slightly different to what we've heard many bands do before, which is to sort of, you know, use the didgeridoo as a slightly backgrounded sound effect in an otherwise one-chord groove tune. We try to make the didgeridoo more of an equal player in our music, but to still keep it sort of contemporary and a little bit edgy. We don't like to get into the sort of mood music thing that this instrument is so often associated with.
Well, how do you keep yourself from becoming a didgeridoo novelty act?
That's a good question. I suppose, you know, at this point, we really still are, especially in the Champaign area. You know, we get a lot of questions about what this instrument is, how do you do it. And I suppose, you know, naturally enough, that's where most of the interest comes for people initially, is because it's not a piano. You know, they haven't seen it since childhood. They don't know what you do with it, what you're supposed to do with it. And, you know, so it's this unique, novel sound. But what we hope is that it sort of hooks them into the sort of bluegrass funk trance music that we do, you know, and keeps them coming back. And potentially, I mean, one of our goals with the band and the business both is to sort of get people just ever so slightly interested in Australian Aboriginal music and Australia. And hopefully, you know, people will go home and, you know, look up more on about this stuff on their own and learn a little bit about where this instrument comes from.
Well, why don't you grab another one and sort of play some more for us?
Right.
And a lot of this is improv, I'm assuming.
That's right. These are, it would be very difficult to notate music for this.
That's what I was wondering, if there's any way, I mean, especially if you're in a band and you have a song, it seems like there would have to be some consistency from, you know, when you play it one night to when you play it the other. But with a didgeridoo, there is no, you know, it's not like like a trumpet,
right,
where there's a set of, you know, notes and you will play these notes.
Sure. Yeah, because what you're working with here is entirely rhythm and color. You know, you can't change notes on a didgeridoo short of taking a chainsaw and chopping off part of it, which would make it look kind of ugly and not be as nice a thing as they are. So, you know, what you're remembering are rhythmic patterns and colors. And because of this, it doesn't lend itself well to sort of Western notation, which is primarily aimed at changes in pitch and rhythm as opposed to color and rhythm. So a good part of sort of composing with a didgeridoo involves memory, you know, remembering specific patterns that you want to play at certain points in the song. And, of course, recording devices help immensely, you know, when you're sort of sketching a tune and trying to keep it fresh for next rehearsal. But, yeah, it's largely improvisational at first when we're writing tunes with the band. And this sort of coheres to some extent, I guess, with what Aboriginal people do with this instrument. It's a little bit jazz-like, the way Yolngu people play this instrument. They have sort of set rhythmic vamps, but good players always vary those vamps. So they'll incorporate more syncopation into an otherwise pretty straight rhythm. They'll throw the beat off just a little bit to the clapsticks just to generate sort of rhythmic interest and add color here and there. And that's sort of the whole art in it. It's the sort of very jazz-like regular cycle with a little bit of improvisation on top of it. Tree Thump, we approach our things the same way. You know, like this would be one of the sort of parts to the tune we do on our album called Astral Highway, which just starts. So you can hear the regular cycle. You can hear the same sort of motif coming back again and again, but each time slightly varied, you know, to sort of sustain the interest of whoever's listening to it.
And you're also moving your fingers up and down
That, I don't know if that is from old training as a brass player, or is that, does that affect the instrument?
No, you know, I think it is an old brass habit. I get questions about this all the time, and I've actually thought about starting to answer them. Yeah, I'm massaging the nodal point to encourage harmonics, but it's just me keeping time. It doesn't really have anything to do with the instrument. Everything really comes from your diaphragm, your voice, your tongue, and your lips.
And which one were you playing right there? That was the...
This is the one made out of agave, okay. the succulent plant that grows in New Mexico. You'll notice each sort of material to the didgeridoo creates a pretty dramatic difference in sound. Generally speaking, like lighter materials like this is a very sort of light, not very dense sort of woody stalk. And it tends to let a lot more of the sound sort of escape through the walls. So it sounds a lot more sort of resonant than, say, this large oaky one, which tends to streamline all the sound out the bell and gives it a more sort of hard-edged, aggressive sound. So, I mean, this is one of the things that we sort of work with as a company when, you know, we're trying to tailor an instrument to someone's specifications, is what kind of grain of wood is going to achieve the sound that they're looking for.
And how long does it take them to fashion a didgeridoo?
Well, you know, it's a really sort of a lengthy multi-part process. Once you've got the wood dry, though, you can get one out in about 2 weeks. There's several steps, you know, as far as in the finishing process it takes to get the instrument looking good and to get it completely sealed. We waterproof all our instruments so they'll last, you know, a lifetime. Otherwise, you would develop cracking problems, which is actually a pretty common issue for people who buy them in tourist shops overseas and bring them home. The climate changes so dramatically that the wood just wants to snap as soon as it's in a different humidity content. Drying the wood can take anywhere from 2 months to half a year. Once that's done, then it's 2 to 3 weeks in and out of the shop.
Well, why don't you play a little bit more from one more of them, and then we'll start to wrap things up a bit.
Okay. So this is the only one you haven't heard yet. This is our little mystery wood, sort of bark left on didgeridoo. It's number 7 of 2009.
And you number all of them?
We number all of them by year and order we collect them in. Yeah, just to sort of, I don't know, keep our records. Part of this is learning, you know, what works as you do it. So we keep a record of all the sort of internal shapes of our didgeridoo, which is the primary factor in shaping the sound. So if someone, you know, were to call us in the future and say, I really like what you did with this instrument, can you make me one like it? We've got records thorough enough to do that for them. So this one, you'll hear that it's much quieter than the other ones you've heard so far. It's also smaller. It was easier to make and would cost less. But it's got this very sort of nice meditative sound to it. It doesn't like being played quite as fast. It sounds like this.
Wow. You can actually really tell the difference between two of them. Just, you know, casually listening, it is pretty obvious.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I mean, people are looking to do all sorts of different things with this instrument. Some people come to it as sort of a form of breathing practice. There was actually a recent medical study by British researchers that suggests that this instrument helps sleep apnea if you learn it. So there are people who approach it in that sort of meditative way as just sort of a you know, recreational relaxation thing. And there are people who want to do things with it more like what we do in tree thumb and use it as sort of a, you know, hard-edged percussive rock and roll instrument. And we like to sort of accommodate both camps with what we do with the Tree Thumb Didgeridoo Company.
Well, if people want to learn more about the band or the company, where should they go?
They should go to www.treethumpdidgco.com. treethumpdidgco.com.
Now let's hear from Clark and the rest of Tree Thump. Here's a cut from their self-titled CD. It's the tune Astral Highway. Astral Highway from the band Tree Thump. You can find out more about the band online at myspace.com/treethump. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. Past episodes of Sidetrack are available on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to will.illinois.edu/sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of Illinois Public Media.